This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, once again to the L-shaped studio in Hoholoon Plaza in beautiful, serene Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is Nick Duke. We are the longest running,
most running
weekly. Episodic
comic book podcast
in all place to be nation.
Now, Greg, let me ask you: what is the subtext of our catchphrase?
Well, I feel like it's really speaking to the nuance and the political dichotomy that exists between the ruling class and the proletariat. Going back to socioeconomical struggles and debates that have been held for centuries.
Yes, quite.
We are the hard-traveling fanboys, ladies and gentlemen, and we are bringing you what I believe is our third episode today of Fix It or Nix It. But before we get into Fix It or Nix It, we actually are presenting to you a very special episode of the hard-traveling fanboys. And no, we're not going to lecture you about the dangers of illicit drugs. We're not going to talk to you about why you should never take candy from a stranger, although it's generally a good idea. What we're here to talk to you about is our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. Ladies and gentlemen, we are starting off with a very special edition of The Rundown. That's right, folks. We are flipping the script on this episode because we have late-breaking news. Right before we were getting ready to go into the studio today and record our show, our program, if you will, we got amazing news. Got to give credit to the manager, Todd Weber, for making us aware of this in a timely fashion. But as some of you know, the HBO Max streaming service is the big project coming out of Warner Brothers. I'm not sure if they've unveiled the release date for this yet, Nick. I'm not 100% sure on that, of when the app is gonna be launched or anything. But we got, for the first time,
but they guaranteed today that you and I are gonna be day one subscribers.
Oh yes, because the big news is big news coming out of here. Greg Berlanti, who is the executive producer and creator of shows such as Arrow, The Flash, Supergirl, Batwoman, Legends of Tomorrow, Titans on DC Universe, among other shows, is going to be executive producing two DC Comics series for HBO Max, one of which is an adaptation of Strange Adventures. And that's great. That should be a really fun series.
It's going to be an anthology show, apparently. Yes. It's going to feature different heroes throughout the DC universe, so we'll probably get to see a lot of quirkier characters that have never made the leap to live action. I'm thinking, you know, stuff like Deadman, maybe the Spectre, who we are going to see in Crisis, but different creature or different characters in that ilk. So I'm excited about that.
Absolutely,
but that Adam is certainly Strange, not the big, you know, news here.
Berlanti describes it as an anthology series of cautionary tales set in a world where superpowers exist. So we are going to be able to see a lot of these, the vigilante, people like that, you know, who else might fall into this realm of you're never going to see a big property about them, but they would fit in well here. Characters like Blue Devil.
Yeah, Blue Devil.
you know, that
Detective Chimp.
Detective Chimp, absolutely.
Although I would be surprised if they don't wind up doing Detective Chimp on Doom Patrol at some point. Mm. Having not seen the show, it just seems like that's a natural fit.
He would fit in well on the show for Sawyton. And then characters like the Sandman and Hourman and people like that. A lot of opportunities here. But let's get to the main event. The reason we decided to flip the script on this. An announcement, Nick, that we have talked about in the past as like a dream project, but we never, ever thought would actually happen.
Well, not just that, but like when we would talk about it as a dream project, we would say things like, as great as the CW shows have been, we didn't really want the CW to do it because of concerns over budget and special effects and that thing. We would say, man, you know, it would be great if somebody like AMC would do it. And I don't think we ever, like, the idea ever crossed our minds that we might be shooting a little higher than even AMC for something like this.
Yeah, so the announcement is that Berlanti will be overseeing a Green Lantern series at HBO Max. And from reading the trade publications about this, the indication is that it's going to have a substantial budget. So,
yeah, go ahead. Basically, Variety is reporting that that Warner Brothers and HBO and you know, Warner Brothers or I guess AT&T at this point, I'm not even sure what the corporate structure is, but the point being, the corporate leadership has taken note of the production values that Disney is pouring into its Disney Plus offerings, whether it be stuff like The Mandalorian or the various MCU shows that we all know are coming. And they are intending for these original DC offerings that are going to be streaming on HBO Max to be the answer to that. That they are intending to give a sizable financial commitment on the level of The Mandalorian or the MCU shows to these DC shows.
Yes, and Nick and I, on these very airwaves, have discussed in the past that we only wanted a Green Lantern show to be done if it could be done right. And our huge concern was the budget. And combination of Berlanti, who has shown a love and an appreciation of DC characters and an ability to translate those characters to the small screen. But when you combine that with the ability to do a budget, and I'm thinking, Nick, imagine if this show has anything even close to even the season one budget of Game of Thrones. It would be amazing. And one of the other articles I read said that Berlanti, it specifically said in the article that Berlanti has not had a chance to do a, quote, big budget comic book show. So that would include the CW shows as not having big budgets and even Titans and Doom Patrol as not having big budgets in comparison to what they envision Green Lantern to be. Nick, this is pretty much a I don't even know, a defibrillator of sorts on us, shocking our very system, if you will.
This is unexpected, to be sure. And now I find my mind just swimming with possibilities of where they could go, the direction they could take. Because the brilliant thing about them doing Green Lantern is this. If you want to draw the Game of Thrones comparison to where now they are trying to actively develop spinoffs of Game of Thrones, not because of just the success, but because the world is so expansive and there's room for it. Of all the properties in the DC universe, Green Lantern is the one that you can absolutely do an expansive, deep universe. Like, it really is a universe unto itself within the DC universe. You can do anything with this. I mean, legitimately, Greg, you can sit here and say a Green Lantern show, I think you could have eight legitimate choices for a lead character.
Yeah.
I mean, just you go so deep here, and there are so many opportunities. I can't wait to see what their take is and the direction they want to go. They could very easily go anthology style, although I kind of hope they do a little bit more of a serial approach. But we'll see. I mean, it's very, very exciting though.
One of the thing we were talking offline, kind of joking about ironclad contracts for the actors, like lock them into. We're gonna want 15 seasons out of this minimum. Lock them in there. But really, in all seriousness, the beauty of Green Lantern, as you alluded to, is you wouldn't have to lock actors up for five, 6 years. If they cast a Hal Jordan or if they cast a Jon Stewart, I don't know, David Ramsey. If they cast a Jon Stewart and he does it for 3 years and he says, you know what, I'm tired of this. I want to go home. It's not going to wreck the entire show. Great. We'll just use Kyle Rayner. We'll just use Hal Jordan. We'll just use Jessica Cruz or Simon Bass.
And then still have room for those original – whoever you start the show with to pop back in for guest appearances or big crossovers, you know, as you go down the line.
You can cycle. You can even focus each season on a different lead character.
I was about to say, here's a crazy idea. What if Sinestro is the main character of the first season?
That would be awesome.
Like, because then you would get to really see the entire, like, fall from grace, you know? How he becomes, exploring the idea of how he becomes disillusioned with the Guardians. I mean, infinite numbers of approaches you could take with this.
And that's to include the possibilities of a loose tie-in to the Arrowverse via John Diggle.
Right.
So, or John Stewart, as they would probably go with. I mean, there are just so many possibilities here. Kilowog and Jessica Cruz and Simon Baz and Guy Gardner.
My lord.
What a world we live in.
They should get Bill Burr to play Guy Gardner.
I actually can see that. He is from Boston, too.
Yes.
He's from Boston and Guy's from Maryland, so not too far away.
Yeah.
We've
just offended our entire Northeastern contingent who was screaming about the difference between Boston and Baltimore. Now I have it on good authority that Sex Ferguson used to sell out Baltimore back in the day.
I heard that too. Now he wasn't working for Watts in those days though.
No, he wasn't working for Watts. That would be when he was making the Crockett run.
No, that would have been when he was working in Tulsa, out in Texas and Oklahoma area. Trying to run against the Blanchards.
No, I'm saying in Baltimore he would have been working for the Crockett.
Oh, yeah. See, I thought you were saying that the Watts run and the Crockett run would have been the same. But you weren't. I got you. I follow you. But hey, we got more news, Nick. Because while this is the big news of the week, and this is really why we started the show this way, we've also got news from the Arrowverse. Because in addition to the Arrow spinoff that we've been talking about for weeks, there's a new report out that Warner Brothers Television is developing another Arrow spinoff centered on Tyler Hoechlin's Superman and Elizabeth Tulloch's Lois Lane for the CW. Titled Superman and Lois, the show will follow the world's most famous superhero and comic book's most famous journalists as they deal with all the stress, pressures, and complexities that come with being working parents in today's society. So that pretty much confirms that we're going to be getting... also, former Flash showrunner Todd Helbing will be heading up Superman and Lois and writing the pilot script. So we're going to be getting John Kent brought to life and a superhero show about working parents, which is pretty freaking cool, Nick.
Yes, it is. As even someone who's not the world's biggest Superman fan, nor was I the biggest fan of the Lois and Clark approach from the 90s, the idea of exploring superhero parenthood is something that even I must you know, cool my Superman-hating heart towards and acknowledge this is a great idea and I'm kind of excited for it.
Yeah.
Also,
it shares a lot of similarities with the Superman comics that you actually did like from Rebirth.
Yes, from Rebirth, yes. And it represents also – the greenlighting of the show represents something of a monumental decision in as it relates to the CW's relationship with Warner Brothers corporate. Because for years, Greg, Superman and Batman and the, quote, big screen characters were considered to be off limits. And we were only going to get Superman in very limited guest appearances on Supergirl. Now we're getting an entire Superman show. I think they are finally starting to realize that there's no harm in having a television version and then doing a separate movie version if you so choose.
Yeah, and we're even getting Bruce Wayne as a recurring character on Titans. We're getting references to him in Batwoman. So, yeah.
I was about to say, I think this demonstrates that it's a matter of time before we have to get a Bruce appearance on Batwoman. Have to.
And hopefully he's not like 60 like he is in Titans. Well, I don't know. It's neither here nor there. But this is exciting. This is very exciting news. I can't wait for this show to happen, and I like what it represents in terms of the change to the approach to these flagship characters. Not that we need a thousand Batman and Superman shows and everything, but to have those characters in play helps everybody, and it helps these other characters they're trying to elevate as well. So, with that being said, one of those characters they're trying to elevate is Batwoman. And the CW has ordered 9 more episodes of Batwoman, bringing the first season up to 22 episodes. So only 3 episodes have aired, and the DVR and streaming viewing is particularly strong, according to Deadline, showing growth among the 18 to 34 demographic. We're hearing so much, Nick, about the demos these days. I feel like I've never heard as much about the demo as I have in the last, month since Dynamite and NXT launched. Mm-hmm. Batwoman is going to get a full season out of this. Now, I hope that Ruby Rose has recovered from her injuries that she suffered, which I don't think we actually talked about on the show, but she suffered some back injuries, I believe.
She has recovered. She's just going to cut back on her stunt work, she said. And rather than doing a lot of the stunts herself, a la Stephen Amell, she's going to basically pick her spots and utilize stunt doubles, which makes sense.
Yeah. Stephen went pretty hardcore, especially in those early seasons. Yeah, it just reminds me of one of the great – well, you're not going to hear this sentence uttered by too many people, Nick. One of the great Horatio Sands impressions of Vin Diesel. I do all my own stunts. You don't remember that, do you? Oh, well.
No, I don't.
Horatio Sands. He had some good stuff, Nick. That and no, too sexy. That was good, too.
Okay.
Unfortunately, what's not okay, Nick, is Freeform's approach to Cloak and Dagger, a show that both of us were impressed by the premiere of and the follow-up episodes, but, as we often do, as I did with Krypton, did not continue watching it, despite the fact that we enjoyed it greatly. And as a result, what do you know? The ratings were poor, and the show has been canceled.
I don't know that this is necessarily due to the ratings, though.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, you got to remember, with Jeff Loeb departing as head of Marvel Television, if I'm not mistaken, this was going to be their only live-action show remaining, because Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was already confirmed to be ending. And most people believe they are just going to sweep all the live-action television now into the MCU under the direct supervision of Kevin Feige. And so I think this is more of an example of them just kind of quietly picking up the pieces and putting them back in the toy box for Feige.
True, although it does say that the characters of Cloak and Dagger will appear in an episode of Runaways on season 3 on Hulu, so who knows?
But I believe that's ending too. I believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is ending as well.
But it's a shame. The one thing that sucks about this is let's be honest, Nick. Nobody has ever cared about Cloak and Dagger. And this show did a lot to change that. I think the show did find a cult following, certainly on social media and things like that, and the leads were very good in this. So I would hope that if Marvel does incorporate these characters, that they would consider bringing in these actors based on the work that they've put in. But we'll see. We'll see how that goes. And we'll also see what comes next on the show, because that's the end of the rundown. Now, Nick, we made this sort of format change right before we went to air. How do we want to approach this? We want to go right into read and watching? Do we want to
We'll do read and watching, then we'll take a break, and then we'll do the rest of the show.
All right. Well, that's fine by me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what we have coming up is a segment where we talk about what we've read and or watched in the last calendar week. It's a segment that we like to call, let's be honest, we call it watching.
What you been watching?
Although, if you're looking for reading material, may I suggest Arnold, Schwarzenegger, and the movies. It is an analytical study of the academic nuances behind Arnold Schwarzenegger's entire film catalog, and it provides excellent reading, and I can't recommend it enough.
Yes.
Intelligent reading for the modern man.
I agree, Nick. It seems to delve deeply into the avoir of his filmography, and showing the ways that he's influenced society through both the culture, but also through the intelligentsia itself. So keep an eye out for that book if you see it anywhere near you. But no, I have almost completed Doomsday Clock, the latest chapter. I had put it down for a while due to other things, and I've picked it up and was reading it right before this broadcast, and made great headway, greatly enjoying it.
and also find myself racking my brain over some things, trying to figure out what's going on, but loving it all the way. But no, let's get into watching, Nick. Before we get into our CW shows, or show in my part, I want to talk about an episode that I watched this past weekend alongside Sunday Groove host David Sunday. I watched the...
You can't watch the damn CW shows, but you find time to watch the godforsaken Walking Dead.
I didn't watch Walking Dead, thank you very much. Did you let me finish? No. You jumped ahead of yourself like a damned fool. Now, as I was saying, I and David Sunday watched the second episode of Titans from this season. Season 2 of Titans. And I am happy to report that the DC4U guys were correct. It is a huge step up from the season premiere. It was very good. Legitimately, perhaps one of, if not the best episode of Titans yet. It was basically a giant love letter to comic book fans in terms of setting up familiar locations, showing how these characters interact with one another. It seems to up the color a little bit on the show. It's a little brighter than the first season was, and even than the premiere was, which, of course, as we know, was shot for last season. It just felt like a new direction, a side of Bruce Wayne that we don't get to see very often, of him actually offering some sage wisdom and advice to Dick over the phone. The nature of the Dick and Jason relationship kind of evolving, and how Dick tries to handle Jason's ego problems. The continued development of Starfire and Wonder Girl as a sort of partnership. An amazing job of establishing the Raven and Beast Boy dynamic and how they interact with one another and with Jason. And just setting up the stage going forward, introducing the character of Ravager, which was very well done. And perhaps most importantly, at the end of the episode, setting the stage for Slade Wilson's further involvement in the series, and really doing a great job, as did the original Teen Titans cartoon show, if you remember, of establishing Deathstroke as this sort of background menace for the entire first season of that show. And in this season, Slade is being established as this impending threat that is coming. We just don't know when. And I thought it was very, very well done. The acting was good. Slade looks like a menace, although we didn't get to see him except in images in this episode. And the girl they cast as Ravager did a really good job. So no complaints here. Everything was a good character development. There was some good fight scenes in this one as well. Looking forward to the rest of the season.
Good to hear. I'll be checking it out at some point. I actually have a flight tomorrow, but I've already downloaded, instead of that, I've downloaded Dolomite Is My Name for watching on the plane.
Well, I have not watched any of the CW shows this past week yet. Not because I don't want to. They're my stories. I'm going to watch them, I promise. But because I just have not had the time.
And I thought you watched Arrow.
No, I did watch Arrow. That's the only one I watched. Arrow was a priority. I will always carve out time for Arrow. But I've watched Arrow. I haven't watched the others. So, Nick, why don't you tell us about the others and just give vague thoughts that won't spoil anything for me.
Supergirl continues to improve, I think, as the season goes along. Still not down with the new Catco storyline, but the Lena dynamic continues to be interesting. And you'll be happy to hear this, Greg. We knew already that Jimmy Olsen was going to be departing the show, and it seems they provided the mechanism in last week's episode. But it would seem, and I haven't seen this week's yet, so I need to confirm, but it sure seems like they're going to have Jenny Olsen exit the show as well alongside him, at least for the time being, which I think is, controversially, I think is a good move. Yes. So,
is her name even Jenny?
I thought it was, yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway, point being, Supergirl was good. Batwoman continues to improve as well. I think the third episode is the strongest of the season thus far. It features Tommy Elliott in the episode, so I'm anxious to hear Greg's thoughts when that time comes. But I thought it was a pretty good portrayal, and again, I think the series continues to improve as it goes along.
You know what, Nick?
Flash was pretty good as well. We get a little bit more of Mohinder as the villain. Dr. Ramsay Rosso, that's his name, right?
Yep.
As the villain Bloodwork, we get to see a little bit more.
It's pretty good.
We get to see how his powers work and a little bit more behind his motivations and stuff. So a little bit of a deeper look at him. We also get introduced in this episode to Ralph's mother, which was a subplot that I wanted to like, but wound up kind of just derailing the episode a little bit in my mind.
What do you make of the new Wells? I haven't seen him in action.
He's okay. He's different. You got to get used to him. It's like an Indiana Jones Wells is what it is. So,
touchdown.
Yeah.
Wells?
And then I have not watched Black Lightning for this week, so that brings us to Arrow.
Yes, Arrow. Oh, my sweet Arrow. Watch that. And in this episode, it's the second part of the unofficial hard-traveling heroes story of Oliver and Diggle and Laurel, in this case, traversing the multiverse and various locales trying to hunt down artifacts for the monitor to be used in the impending crisis. And in the first episode, he got this star energy matter. And in the second episode, he is back on his Earth, Oliver's Earth, looking for a scientist, a mad scientist perhaps, but a scientist nonetheless that the monitor wants for reasons unknown. And Oliver and Diggle are down with this mission. They've learned their lesson after what happened to Earth 2 before, but now Laurel is hell-bent on trying to get back to her Earth, not understanding that her Earth no longer exists. Lila comes into this episode as well and plays a pretty significant role by the end. We also, notably, as they're in Hong Kong, we see the return of a fan favorite character, certainly one of my favorite characters on the show, Katana, played by Rila Fukushima, who many people may know from The Wolverine. She played Yukio in The Wolverine, and she was awesome. She was great on Arrow as well, and here she has returned as Katana, and really has some great scenes here, I thought, with Stephen Amell, who shows just an incredible amount of emotion about the level of sacrifice that he's putting in to this mission and the idea that what if it's all for nothing? He can't face that reality. And then, of course, at the end of the episode, we find out that the next episode is going to be taking place in Nanda Parbat, which perhaps means a little bit of League of Assassins situation going on here, League of Shadows. So, really good episode, Nick. This show just continues to kick ass. This season, it reminds me a lot of the beginning of last season with just a ton of momentum right out of the gate.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very different season of Arrow than anything we've seen before, and yet I'm loving it. It really is, as they described it, kind of a greatest hits of the show. We are seeing little homages to pretty much every era of Arrow, and I am so pumped for next week's episode.
Me too. And one of the things that I got to shout out here, because I'm me, and I'm an action movie aficionado, the fight scenes in this were right out of season 1 and 2 of Arrow. Some really tremendous combat sequences in the hallway from Oliver and Diggle at the beginning of the episode, and then notably an elevator fight scene with Oliver where they actually have a little bit of that dry action movie humor in there where he gets done with the fight, and then he just almost looks at the camera and says, "Ouch." And, you know, just really good stuff there. Great choreography here. Whoever's doing the stunt coordination in this episode was excellent. The fight between Katana and China White, who also returned in this episode, was really, really good. And yeah, I thought it was a fantastic episode. So excited for Nanda Parbat to see what comes next. Maybe even a return in some form or another of Ra's al Ghul.
We'll see. Maybe.
Touchdown, Bills. Well, with that being said, that's the end of my watching, Nick. Have you watched anything else comic book related?
I have not.
Well, that's fine. Oh, we didn't even talk, Nick, about the fact that we're done with Walking Dead Month. How great is that?
That is great. That really is great.
Finally, we're done with that. All right, now, do we want to go ahead and get into looking at the clock on the wall here? or do we want to save?
No, that's end of the show stuff. Yeah, that's right, end of the show
right,
stuff.
All right. Well, what we're going to do right now, folks, is we're going to take a little break-a-rooney, and when we come back on the other side of the break, we are going to have the Fix It or Nix It on Josh Trank's controversial movie, Fanfortstic 4? And we'll have some other stuff, too. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen.
God almighty, here we go.
Greg Phillips here, Nick Duke. And listen, Nick, pretty good.
It sounds like Chris Berman's been to the dungeon there.
Well, yeah, if you wanted to talk, if you wanted to try me, Reds, why the hell didn't you try me?
I don't know why I make Stu sound, disadvantaged. But nonetheless, we are back, and we are here not to talk about Stu Hart or the Dungeon or Chris Berman or Tom Jackson or anything like that. We're here to talk to you all for Fix It or Nix It about the controversial Josh Trank 2015 film Fantastic, or if you prefer, Fantastic Four. Of course, this is the second attempt at actually the third attempt to bring Fantastic Four to the big screen.
Well, actually the fourth.
Tell me more, Nick.
The Roger Corman Fantastic Four, which was never released but was in production.
Sure. What I meant was the third attempt to kickstart a Fantastic Four franchise. I wasn't counting Rise of the Silver Surfer, being as it was part of the previous franchise, but certainly Roger Corman, Tim Story in 2005, and then 10 years later from that, we get this very different approach from Josh Trank, who was most known for the film Chronicle, a well-regarded movie that I still haven't seen. Nick, have you seen Chronicle?
I have not, despite urging at various points that I just absolutely had to see it. I have somehow avoided it.
Yes, same here. However, this movie, of course, as many will remember, was plagued with controversy, even in its production. Had supposedly one of the most troubled productions in major Hollywood recent history, with outright rebellion amongst the cast, rumors that the director had gone rogue on the set, also the rumors that Josh Trank himself had edited together a version of the movie that the studio rejected and then re-edited to put out a different movie because they were unsatisfied with what he had done. So there's it's just a Danny hodgepodge of issues with this film. But what we're not here to necessarily review this film. Both of us watched this movie in its entirety for the first time, I believe, setting up for this podcast. Is that correct, Nick?
Yeah. I had seen bits of it, like on TV or whatever, but this is the first time I've sat and watched the entire thing end to end.
I had only seen the very beginning on TV, and so I went into this largely blind. But we're not here necessarily to review the film. Suffice it to say, the movie's bad. It is a bad movie.
Yeah.
I think the degree of badness is a little bit differentiated, but we'll get into that with what we're about to talk about. So in Fix It or Nix It, our mission to ourselves, should we choose to accept it, is to try and take the worst comic book films that have been made and fix them, if they can be fixed. And Fantastic Four is an interesting one to hit with, Nick, because I've long made no secret of my thoughts on the Fantastic Four, have I?
No, you haven't. You're against them.
Right? Firm, I'm against them. And I believe that in the modern era, they are facing some fundamental hurdles if you're trying to get them to click with a modern movie-going audience. And what are those hurdles? Well, I think the hurdles come in the form of the family Richards. I believe that Reed Richards and his wife Sue are difficult to make interesting. I've felt this way since I was a kid, by the way. Whenever I would encounter the Fantastic Four in a crossover comic, which wasn't often with the stuff that I read, the cartoon series certainly that came out in the 90s that I watched, even the movie with Jessica Alba and all those others in 2005, Reed is always the least interesting member of the team, and yet is always the focus of seemingly every Fantastic Four story that I ever come across. And this one's no exception, by the way. To the detriment of the other characters, in fact. But I think that the Fantastic Four is a property that needs to be thought about in an outside-the-box way. And in my opinion, that means something like doing a period piece, because the Fantastic Four are so much of the space age, or doing a self-aware, lighthearted family comedy, doing something...
Which is kind of the approach that Tim Story took, but as we discussed offline, I get the impression he probably, in that era of superhero films, probably wasn't allowed to really fully... veer into that.
Yes, that's editorial interference probably, and you know, he may have been leaning on possibly doing something more along the lines of The Incredibles, something more along the lines of even, you know, a family-friendly version of what we saw years later with Deadpool, something that doesn't take, importantly, does not take itself or its material seriously. And that's just my opinion. I know many will disagree with that. Many Fantastic Four fans will probably bristle at that, in fact. But I'm basing it off of all the attempts that have been made, and none of them have taken off in any form, really. The cartoon didn't do well. The movies, none of the movies have done particularly well. I mean, first one did okay. But, you know, they're just not that they're not that compelling when you compare them to their... they're competitors. But I would say, before we even get started, my way to fix this movie would be to approach it in an entirely different way, because Josh Trank chooses to approach it.
But that gets back to...
I know. I'm gonna challenge myself more than that. I'm gonna challenge myself, but I feel like, you know, Josh Trank decides to lean the opposite way on this. His approach to a Fantastic Four movie is to make it very serious and to make it very gritty and very dark. Darkly lit, everything about it is dark, and to lean on the hard and heavy science aspect of it. Now, that being said, I don't know if the hard science is real or not. I'm not a scientist, but I do know that it's a totally different approach to the Fantastic Four than I would take, leaning more on the stuff that to me didn't work in the Tim Story movies. So I would say that to add one thing that I would say that is not too sweeping of a change would be simply to add more humor to this movie, because there is almost none here throughout the entirety of the film until they get to the end, Nick, and they have that uproariously funny final scene. Anyway, yeah. So let's get some of your thoughts on the movie and that conversation, and then we'll get into some ways that you think this movie possibly could have been salvaged.
Well, to start with, I had not seen this in the entire way through ever. Not even when it was released in theaters, even though I see most comic book movies in theaters. And the reputation this film has had, both online and from people I know who have actually seen it, is that it is one of the worst comic book movies ever made. That it is right there in terms of the Electras and Catwomans of the world is what come to mind most immediately. And let me be clear. This film it's not good. It's a bad movie. That being said, I did not find it as unwatchable and as bad as I had been informed that it was. And perhaps that is just an example of expectation affecting perception. But I feel like there are moments of this movie where I can kind of see what the approach was intended to be, even if the execution is piss poor throughout, and especially in the form of editing the film, which I think is going to represent the biggest opportunity on the fix-it side of this as we move into that discussion.
Yes, and it's interesting because I thought the film was worse than you did, but I already went in with my Fantastic Four bias. Also,
right.
Also, I thought the editing here was even more egregious than the bad editing in Green Lantern. And it outright broke whatever elements of the movie did work for me. And there were some, not many, but some elements of this movie that worked for me. So let's start out with the cast. We have a not terrible cast here. Pretty good actors on here. We've got the likes of Miles Teller as Reed Richards, and he's fine. Michael B. Jordan as Johnny Storm. He's actually probably the highlight of the movie for me in his brief.
But not in it enough.
Oh, my God. Because everything's about Reed. The whole movie, they might as well have renamed this Mr. Fantastic the movie, because that's really all it's about. Then you've got Kate Mara as Sue Storm, and I didn't think she brought a lot to the table in this. And Jamie Bell as Ben Grimm. And I don't blame the actor here, but my God, this is not in the comics. Ben Grimm is probably the most interesting member of the Fantastic Four to most people. And here he is probably, other than Reed, the least interesting member of the team because he doesn't have a personality to speak of.
Yeah, I would agree.
You also get Toby Kebbell as a very unique version of Victor Von Doom. And Reg E. Cathy as the somewhat creepy Dr. Franklin Storm. And let's not, you know, he's not going to probably.
I liked that.
I did too.
I don't know.
I did too.
I thought Franklin was the most interesting character in the movie, honestly.
Yes, and had some of the only good scenes in the movie. But
right.
I can't finish the cast yet without mentioning Delmar himself, Tim Blake Nelson, in the wasted role of Dr. Harvey Allen.
Yes.
For those that don't know Tim Blake Nelson, just go watch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou and thank us later.
He's done other things, but that's really what we need to focus on here.
The important thing that he did was he played Delmar.
He was going to be the leader, but then Edward Norton and Marvel got pissed at each other and that wound up not happening, but that's just another story for another time.
Oh, George, not the livestock.
The livestock. Sir, some of your folding money's come unstole.
Oh boy! Why don't the Coen brothers do a comic book movie?
Oh, they should.
Anyway, So looking at this cast, Nick, before we get into the elements of the story that you could change, mm-hmm. that I could change, anything you would change about this cast?
Recast the thing, but well, it's like you said. How much of it is the actor's fault, and how much of it is the script's fault? Because even if they got a better actor. Could much have saved this particular incarnation of Dr. Doom, for example? Like, I don't know. So I find it hard to take much exception here with the cast.
I tend to agree.
For what it's worth, as boring as I'll go with you that Reed Richards is a fairly boring character. I thought Miles Teller busted his ass to make that character far more interesting. Like. In the hands of most other people, it would have been even worse. I thought he did as good a job
Add some elements of pathos to the role.
Yeah, some pathos and kind of like this aw shucks boy next door. He tried not to overdo it with like the ego, which I think is arguably the worst trait of Reed Richards in many of his comic stories. he kind of underplays his self-confidence and stuff here, which kind of works. But there's he can only do so much with this script, because the movie really, like, editing is an issue, but I don't know that pacing is an issue, because if anything, I think it tries to get to things too quickly.
It moves too quickly. I was about to say the same thing. This movie, in the here's the other thing. The pacing issues come in because they spend entirely too much time on the people, on Reed Richards, Johnny Storm, Sue Storm, and Ben Grimm before they ever become the Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. Most of the movie, in fact, Nick, is spent on them before they become fantastic. And in, again, dealing with some characters that are not very interesting to start with, that's an uphill climb. I don't care if you're doing an origin movie. That's an uphill climb when more than 50% of the movie is them not even being established yet. You can get away with it in some cases, you know, but really, if you even the great origin movies and comic books, we tend to get to them as their characters fairly expediently, you know. When you take this much time, you're flirting with disaster, as the Molly Hatchet song.
Yeah,
says.
Because then you have to rush the back half of the film, which is, I mean, if you're going to do an origin movie, you kind of follow that classic setup of the first half is really the origin, the back half is where the action gets going. And here, when you do that, you're left with very little real estate for the actual action. And as far as action goes in this movie, there's practically none. I mean, there's one very, very brief fight scene with Mr. Fantastic against the military in the woods. Then there's a pretty lackluster action sequence that ends the movie on Planet Zero, also known as the Negative Zone, and every other story involving the Fantastic Four ever told. But that's kind of my – I don't know.
Yeah, and Reed Richards, who is already, as I mentioned, not an interesting character, the filmmakers make a curious choice of skipping ahead a year at one point during the movie.
Okay. See, this, if we're going to talk about the year time jump, to me, the way I fix this movie almost entirely relates to this one year.
I
want to
hear your
jump.
Theory. I think you have probably a more concrete plan than I do on this. So go ahead and tell us what your thoughts.
Okay.
Are.
So the movie leading up to the 1 year time jump to me is, I mean, again, it's not good, but it is watchable. Everything after the time jump is where the movie earns its bad reputation. Everything after the time jump, whether it is Mr. Fantastic fighting the military in the woods, whether it's the climactic action sequence, whether it's the cheesy final scene, everything after the time jump is bad. So when this movie was being made, and you would read interviews with Josh Trank or with the producers or whoever, they talked about how they kind of wanted to take inspiration from David Cronenberg and do a little bit of a body horror twist on the Fantastic Four, which, while it sounds silly, given your thoughts on Fantastic Four being primarily a comedic concept, there is a hint of that in early Fantastic Four comics, of them having to cope with the fact, the idea of like how much they've changed, mm-hmm. and how that affects their lives. This movie, despite them promising that in interviews and in promotion, really robs the movie of all of that by utilizing the 1 year time jump, because pretty much what happens is the accident happens, they come back, they get their powers, and we go straight into the 1 year time jump. So instead of seeing them dealing with their powers, trying to figure out how it all works, instead of seeing Ben Grimm work through his new appearance, the movie jumps forward a year and hits this magic button of just, well, now everybody has their powers and knows how to use them, and they all have their dynamics established. Which, to me, if you're going to fix this movie, you can pretty much do it the exact same way. There are a couple of changes I would make. One, in this film, they gain their powers because they go rogue and make this mission to Planet Zero when it sounds like they're going to get edged out a little bit. And the people who go to Planet Zero are Ben, Reed, Johnny, and Victor Von Doom. Here's what I do. There is no reason to not give Sue Storm the agency enough to go on that mission with them to make that decision and be complicit in it and to have her actually go there. That felt a little bit betraying to the character, honestly. Like, she needs to be right alongside the others and not just kind of – because I was confused when it happened. I was like, well, how did she exactly get her powers then if she wasn't there? Did that make any sense to you?
Only in so far as when they get back, there's this big explosion of energy – and the energy wave washes over her, and the presumption is that the energy wave had elements of Earth Zero that gave her powers. But I totally agree with you. I thought it was weird. I didn't get it. I didn't know why she wasn't going with them. So, particularly, what was then the point of the early scenes in which Reed and, I guess it was supposed to be scenes of Reed and Sue bonding, when that doesn't really ever play a role?
Play in, right. But they did it because they felt like they had to because of the source material. But anyway, so first thing I would do, really, I mean, like, I would probably cut a little bit off of that opening sequence with the kid stuff. Yes. Like, it's okay, but you could cut it in half.
And it's probably too obvious. Like, you get the idea very quickly. So all this – and the stuff with Ben being bullied by his older brother doesn't play a factor in the movie. So cut that.
Or if you're going to have him being bullied, have it actually be the Yancey Street Gang or something that, you know, is a common feature of the comics. Anyway, but yeah, cut that opening scene a little bit. The stuff where they're at the Baxter Foundation, I mean, it's okay. Like the Victor stuff, you'd have to rewrite the character from the ground up. So I'm going to approach this as if
this is just
we're dead set on using that version of the character, and here we go. Anyway,
I agree. The stuff at the Baxter Building to me is probably my favorite stuff in the movie. Like when they were there before they built the machine, probably the best stuff, and kind of establishing how frustrated Victor is at being manipulated by the Tim Blake Nelson character and people like that.
So here's what happens. They have the same scene where they get told, hey, we're going to send NASA in now. You guys are off the project or whatever. Instead of Victor, who completely out of character, wants to bond with everybody by going drinking, let's have Victor storm off. Let's have the four who remain, you know, let's have them go on the rogue mission into the Phantom or into the Negative Zone. They come back, they've got their powers, and when they come back, Victor is returned. He sees them going. He's like, wait a minute, you did this without me, and he decides to go by himself. And then when the machine comes back through, Victor's not there anymore. And so you kind of have this mystery of what happened to Victor. And then what I would do is, we don't see Victor again the rest of this movie at all. What happens from there, for me, is instead of doing the one-year time jump, they have to deal with that whole like experience of having of learning how to use their powers. And by doing this, we also get to see something that is not in the movie at all. We would get to see an actual dynamic develop between Johnny Storm and Ben Grimm, which is honestly the most appealing thing about the Fantastic Four as a family dynamic is those two, you know, the bickering uncles, essentially. Yeah. We would get to see that. We would get to see Reed's guilt over Ben's appearance. We would get to see Ben's depression. We would get to see Sue trying to be the not quite the mother figure yet, but trying to be the person holding them all together when they're all lost in their own depression and self-involvement. And in the course of that, you can easily work in Tim Blake Nelson's character to want to send soldiers across to gain powers the same way they did. The soldiers come back, and there's your generic villain for them to fight in the final act of the movie. They finally come together, and you never see Victor again. You save Victor entirely for a sequel if it ever happens. And this way, the pacing of the movie is settled down a little bit. You get more of that body horror bent they were talking about. And I think you get more focus on the bonding of these four as a dynamic. Because really, by the end of the movie, I am not sold on these guys being a team at all. No. It doesn't really make sense. I mean, the take they go with is that Reed basically runs away from them for an entire year. They should all hate Reed, justifiably. And I don't think anything in the climax of the movie is enough to warrant an attitude shift in that. So for me, delay the actual Dr. Doom villain part until a sequel if it ever happens, and focus primarily on the Fantastic Four themselves in the back half of this movie. And if you want to tie it into a comic book villain origin, you could have like Tim Blake Nelson's character, as was originally rumored, send some soldiers across, and when they come back, they're basically his minions or whatever. Like, he's got some sort of mind control over them, and that sets up like a Mole Man type situation or whatever you want to go with. Puppet Master, I guess you could also do it that way. But yeah, I would... Everyone, you know, Fantastic Four is a lot like Batman, or not like Batman, because Batman has a much deeper rogues gallery that makes it more frustrating, but everyone just wants to do Doctor Doom when they get the Fantastic Four, and I think a little bit of patience in that regard would have gone a long way for this movie.
That's really good, Nick. That sort of revised script, if you will, rebook in the territory, which is really what ultimately my vision of this podcast series was, is sort of rebooking the territory, you know, rebooking some of these movies to see how we can possibly fix them. And I think you did a very good job of that just now, certainly better than I can do. I think if I were going to sort of do something a little bit different than what you've laid out, I love pretty much everything that you laid out here. I think I can still work within the confines, because I'm assuming the studio steps in and says, no, we need Dr. Doom. We're going to have Dr. Doom in this movie. So if you go with this version of Dr. Doom, which is, as we talked about, a flawed foundation, but let's go with it. You have...
Well, one other thing on Dr. Doom before I move on. Part of the problem with this version of Dr. Doom, in addition to the characterization, is the power set they give him.
So vain.
He should just destroy the Fantastic Four, because basically they show him liquefying someone's brain with his mind. So, mm-hmm. like, why should any of the four be able to stop him? It doesn't make any sense.
He appears to be able to control all matter. He appears to be able to control...
He's essentially Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah, very much. And there's no way the Fantastic Four should be able to beat him. I agree. Especially when they have no teamwork experience together. They all make this up on the fly after an inspiring speech from Reed on Earth Zero. But, you know, okay, I think... First of all, I really think you need more time to tell the story. But if you're limited to the same runtime here... I think you add 30 minutes on to this runtime, and you could easily fill that out with adding characterization, added action, things of that nature. But I would cut from the beginning part of the movie, the same as you. I would maybe have that. I wasn't a big fan of that opening scene, honestly. But maybe you show Reed and Ben at the junkyard, and maybe that's your first scene, and kind of establish that Reed is trying to build this machine. Do the high school stuff, the Baxter building. And then I agree with you on the 1 year later time jump. That was a huge mistake. But I could even keep the part where they're on Earth Zero, although I would send 5 instead of 4, and Reed can't save Victor. One of the things that bothered me watching this movie is that when Victor finally reemerges, he's not bitter and angry at Reed or Ben or Johnny for leaving him behind. In fact, he doesn't appear to care about them at all. He barely even acknowledges them. He's just out here for his weird pseudo-environmentalist message to destroy Earth before it destroys itself and leave Earth Zero as his own planet to redesign in his image. I wanted to see Doom come back with a little bit of that venom, a little bit of that anger towards and that bitterness towards Reed. Because remember, being stuck on a planet all alone, while this version of Doom seems to embrace that, could also drive a guy a little crazy. And so maybe when Victor comes back from the Earth Zero, he realizes that these people left him behind. In his mind, even though they didn't do it intentionally, they had to get out of there, but they left him behind, and now, you know, they've ruined his life, and he's lost however long it's been. They could even reveal that it's like the Phantom Zone, where time passes differently there. So while it's been a year for us, it's been 10 years or 15 years for Victor. And he's bitter,
like,
and he hates Reed because of this. It gives a reason for the enmity, which I didn't really buy in this movie either. The sort of professional jealousy between the two of them, I didn't buy that when it came up at the end of the movie, because I didn't think it had been well established. So I think then you keep the stuff with Doom in this version. It's still not going to be a good movie, but it can be an okay movie of Doom wanting to, you know, wipe out the Earth and make Earth Zero his home or whatever. But and then you need to have more time of the Fantastic Four bonding. In your version, Nick, what I like about your version is you could always do the post-credit scene that shows Dr. Doom in his full regalia.
That shows he's alive, he survived, that whole deal.
To set up the sequel. So, I mean, yours is better, but if I were going to do something different, that's kind of what I would do, just because I think one of the things that defines Dr. Doom, and I don't know much about the character, I've not read the Fantastic Four extensively, but it seems to be that a bitterness and an envy of Reed Richards has always kind of struck Doom, and I could see him both being upset that Reed left him behind and took years of his life away, and also maybe bitter that Reed's powers don't affect him as obviously as what happened to Ben and what happened to Victor. So maybe you can build on that. I wanted more bitterness and enmity from Doom and more of a personal stake in what he's doing than this grand global vision that he has.
Well, I mean, if you want to get the personal stake, you could also just lean more into his jealousy of Reed and Sue growing closer together. Right. Like, if there's more of that in the beginning of the movie, it's hinted about in the existing version, but there's not enough of it to really warrant the personal vendetta against
Reed. They never even show them having a private conversation together, to my recollection, right. Talking about, you know, their past together and everything. So, yeah, there's that element would have helped a lot. There's one other thing, and this sort of gets into review territory, and I don't really want to do that necessarily, but the action scenes that are there are not bad for the most part. They could have been much better and much longer and been built to and told a story. However, the one thing that I just could not get out of my head in this, Nick, is, in my opinion, how absolutely awful the Mr. Fantastic effects were.
They're bad.
I about laughed out loud when he did the stretchy punches really? To Dr. Doom.
The effects in general in this movie aren't that great. Like, how about all they do a CGI chimp for the experiment.
Oh, he looked terrible.
And you could have just done a real chimpanzee, because all they're doing, they're not doing anything dangerous with him. He's just sitting in a pod. That's all they use him for. Why even CGI the damn chimp? You probably spent more money building the computer model for the stupid chimp than it would have cost you to just hire one for the day and just take a few shots of him sitting in a chair.
It didn't help that it looked like a Legends of Tomorrow era, budget effect versus versus a cinematic effect. No, I agree with you. That one thing I did not mind as much was Ben Grimm in this one. I didn't think the Thing looked awful as I thought he would. Not great, but certainly could have been worse. But then there's also an element, we've laid out how we would kind of fix this thing. There's also an element to this movie of still trying to seemingly avoid looking like a comic book. Ben walks around naked and which, why would he wear shorts? Well, because they're a team and they wear a uniform and all that. But, I don't know.
Did we ever get a real good look at whether there's a rock dong down there or not?
I don't think they gave us a good look at it. You know, it was hard to even tell what he was at first. There's a lot of problems with this movie. But yeah, I think you laid out a great way to fix it. I laid a way to kind of tweak it to at least make it slightly workable, I think, and make it a little bit more watchable and enjoyable than what we got. But nonetheless, this was a challenge. However, I will say, from the tenor of both our conversations, I think to you, this was an easier fixable movie than Elektra was. And I think for me, it's a little bit maybe the other way around. But they were both bad movies. I thought that Elektra had stuff in it that did work. But again, you'd have to rebook the entire movie to really make that stuff work and stick with one genre. Here, there's no way to really make it work, but maybe you could turn it into something ultimately better than what we got. So this was a more fixable movie.
Yeah, I would agree.
Well, there you have it, folks. We have attempted to fix Josh Trank's Fantastic Four. What do you think? We want to hear your thoughts on this movie. Do you think that it could have been fixed at all? Do you think there are elements that could have made it at least better than what it was? Drop us a line on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. You can go to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and leave a comment under this article and let us know your thoughts on Josh Trank and the Fantastic Four movie, things that could have been done differently. And kind of, it could also springboard us into another conversation, Nick, of what do we think would make a good Fantastic Four movie? There have been so many different attempts at it right now. What would work in 2019, maybe that wouldn't have worked 20 years ago, in terms of bringing the Fantastic Four to the big screen? Is it as simple as just, what in the devil was that? Is it as simple as just essentially recreating the Kirby and Lee comics? Or is it something like I've suggested where they should lean into the comedy aspects of it? A period piece, things of that nature. I'm interested to hear some ideas on this. What are your thoughts, Nick?
Oh, man. So many different directions you go. I tend to also agree that it's probably time to veer more into the comedy of it, which is why I think the general tenor of the MCU is almost the perfect environment in which to make a Fantastic Four movie. But, you know, I also think there's something to the period piece aspect. Period piece is probably the one I most want to see, because outside of X-Men First Class, have we really seen a period piece superhero movie? I'm having trouble thinking of one.
Captain America, the First Avenger.
Captain America, the First Avenger would be the only other one, right? But Fantastic Four, as you said, would examine a different time period. Yeah. I mean, this would space be race. Set in the 60s, space race. You could even like knock it up a little bit and go, you know, late 60s if you wanted it to fit into that kind of flower power and like hippie type stuff. I mean, there's all different kinds of approaches you could take with this. But I would say comedic period piece would be the one I would most want to see. But I have, as I've said numerous times at this point, I have all the faith in the world in Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios to get it right, and I know they will when the time comes.
Well, that's about it for Fix It or Nix It. And, you know, as I stare at the clock in the corner of my computer screen here, Nick, I can only notice that it's telling me right now that it's time for the Wrestling Minute. Now, Nick, you're not—you're talking about me with the CW shows. You're having a tough time keeping up with wrestling these days because you've been—you're quite behind right now on your Dynamite and your NXT and a litany of things, right?
That's true. I am updated on Raw, but I have to, you know, and I've been following the results of the other shows, so I can at least have something of a discussion. But yes, I am behind. That is true. It is, with the stories being back, with football still season still in effect, my time is limited.
I also understand that you suffered a devastating wrestling-related injury when Bobby Lashley kicked you in the testicles and made out with your wife over top of your prone body.
Well, he did do that, but luckily while it was happening, I could touch myself for pleasure.
Very good. Very good. So, yes, I thought Raw, by the way, this latest edition of Monday Night Raw was really good, especially from a wrestling standpoint anyway. A lot of good wrestling matches on that show. AJ Styles versus Humberto Carrillo. I almost said it, but I didn't.
You did.
I almost said my old pseudonym from college.
How does Jasper Stillwater St. Clair play in all this?
I'll have to call brother Eugene Otis to ask him about that. The audience of two, my friend.
God.
The Drew McIntyre and Ricochet match was out of this world good. And then, of course, Becky and Kairi Sane had a really good match, I thought. So, strong wrestling from the brand that is not always known for that in the past.
I said after the draft, Paul Heyman getting the likes of Buddy Murphy and Cedric Alexander and Humberto Carrillo, although I didn't think of that at the time, I kind of got the inclination that we were going to see a shift in Raw's approach, and it certainly seems that's starting to play out.
Indeed, and I also love the presentation of Drew McIntyre right now. And also, didn't even mention this,
the presentation of Drew McIntyre is fine, but, you know, he is going to have to find, he's going to find his justice, his comeuppance.
Oh boy.
This coming Thursday.
You just don't learn, dude.
I can see in the form of a Superman punch and a spear from the big dog, Roman Reigns.
I'm there. All I have to say about Team Hogan is when they get to Saudi, they're going down, and that goes for the big dog too, because I'm tired of looking at him.
Well, you know, I would point you again to Ric Flair's all-time win-loss record against Hulk Hogan in any form of competition. And
but
not kind. Not kind,
the
sir.
Events of Monday Night Raw and think that Team Hogan even has a chance. Ricochet, I will remind you, damn near broke his neck on that RKO, and may not even be fit to compete for all we know when it comes time for this show. Orton looks like the much more enthusiastic leader of his team. Big Dog's doing a good job. Big Dog put in a good effort on Friday night, by the way. Put out, got a good win for his six-man team. Ali picked up the win for his six-man team on Friday night. That's fair. But I think right now, Flair's got all the momentum right now. They've taken the momentum back after what happened on Raw, and with a hobbled Ricochet, he's already got kinesio tape on his ribs. I don't know what that does exactly, but it's there. And Team Flair, they're healthy. They're ready. They're doing jumping jacks practically. They're excited to get there to the kingdom of Saudi Arabia and
whip some Hulkamania
ass.
The coaching on Team Hogan will be clearly superior and will be the difference maker this coming Thursday.
Barry Odom.
Ric Flair.
That's going to be Feinbaum. Feinbaum on Friday morning is going to be all, or Friday afternoon is going to be all fired up about why Ric Flair or Hulk Hogan need to be removed from their positions as coaches.
Tony Barnhart joining us. Tony, Ric Flair.
Phil, I don't understand.
You just said Phil.
Whatever. Phil.
Same difference.
Oh, boy. No, but yeah.
Go back to hell or the Paramore show. Same difference.
Boy, I would love to get Phil's wrestling takes on this Jordan Miles situation.
Good God, the audience of two continues.
All right, well, the Dynamite was excellent, by the way, again last week, as was NXT.
Highlight.
Yes, the Dynamite segment of the night was the Jericho and Cody brawl that featured Jericho with some classic Jericho lines, trash-talking MJF, and MJF comes out and says, you think I'm going to be scared of a guy who wears a scarf? Who wears a scarf? So good. So self-aware. So excellent. And then NXT, we haven't talked about this, Nick, the shocking heel turn of Finn Balor. Where do we think this is leading?
Yes. No idea. Is he going to align with the Undisputed Era? Is he going to create his own sort of deal there in NXT? Nobody knows, but I'm excited to see where it goes.
I am too. I think it's a much needed freshening up of Finn. So I'm excited to see what happens next on that brand moving forward. I think SmackDown's taking steps in the right direction. Last week was a good show with what you have to say, Nick, is a clear Pritchard influence.
Clear Pritchard influence, yes.
And overall, the state of wrestling is quite healthy. And there's other stuff going on in the world of wrestling as well that we're not going to talk about right now. But we also have New Japan that is making some headway right now, getting ready for Wrestle Kingdom in just a couple months. So,
and announcing a full-time U.S.
Yes, okay.
Territory.
Yeah, what do we think of that, Nick?
No idea. I mean, are they going to hire a separate roster and share between the, I mean, nobody knows really what this is, so I'm interested to see.
Meltzer said in the Observer, you and I have had the potential chance to view a copy of recently, that the current plan for the American wing is to have the top stars that are not being used right now at certain times in New Japan and major angles to come over and also to have some of the bigger stars than that when they're available. If they're doing like a junior tournament, you might get Okada over here and stuff like that. If they're doing G1, you might get the juniors over here. The plan is to divide it regionally and to run, I think it said, 5 shows in each region, 5 Southeast, 5 Northeast, Midwest.
A year?
I think that's what he said, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Now, where at in these locations, I don't know. But Meltzer's also not sure of the actual viability of this whole thing. But
yeah. I would assume the U.S. title, the IWGP U.S. title, becomes the featured.
Could be.
I guess.
Could be. I don't know. That makes sense. Makes a little sense. And the other aspect is they said that they're already trying to sign up a lot of foreign talent to be trained, foreign to Japan talent, to be trained at the L.A. dojo by
Katsuyori Shibata.
Thank you. Because Shibata's getting a reputation as a really good trainer, so they want him to start training.
Yes, he's been involved with the LA dojo for some time.
Yeah, they want him to start training the Americans and the Canadians and the European wrestlers that they're signing up as young boys and whatnot. So could be fun. We'll have to check it out if they come here to the Southeast. Kind of like we'll have to check out Dynamite if they ever come around this.
They announced the Jacksonville Dynamite, but it's on New Year's, so yes. I won't be able to make that.
But there may be other considerations there, but surely they'll come closer than Jacksonville.
Yes, surely.
Hey, I don't put the cart before the horse, Nick. When they come to our geographic region, we'll be checking them out. So anyway, that's the end of the Wrestling Minute. And, you know, other than that, there's not much going on around the... Hold on, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting a little sheet of paper sliding out of here through the slot on the thing here. And it says here, oh my God, it's the Ho-Ho Loon ticker. And it says, breaking news, Ho-Ho Loon still located on the award-winning WWE Network in the biography section. Can you believe it, Nick?
Excellent. I can't believe it. I can't believe it at all.
What does it all mean, Basil?
I don't know. But with that being said, I think it's time to go ahead and end the show. We're going to end it as we have for some time now with the finest tradition in the Hard Traveling Fanboys pantheon. That, of course, being our show closing musical number from WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. And this week, in honor of Halloween, it may be Halloween when you're listening to this podcast. Halloween may have just occurred when you're listening to this podcast. So a little tune that reminds me of the Halloween times, done in the vocal stylings of Mr. Jim Ross. JR, take it away.
First of all, I believe you mean a tune. Mm. And second of all, this song actually accompanies a dance. And I'm going to attempt to do this dance right here in the Hard Traveling Studio. And if you haven't seen old JR dance before, well, you ain't lived. It is close to midnight, right here on TBS The Superstation in the WCW Power Hour. Something evil is lurking from the dark. It's the Dead Man. Under the moonlight, you see a sight that almost stops your by God heart. You try to scream, but terror takes the sound before you make it. You start to freeze as horror, the chamber of horrors, man, looks you right between your eyes. You're paralyzed. Because this is a thriller. Thriller night. And no one's going to save you from the beast Brock Lesnar, who is about to strike. You know it's thriller. Sorry, folks. Thriller night. You're fighting for your by God life inside a killer thriller tonight. Oh, yeah. I'm going to bring it tonight. You hear the door slam and realize there's nowhere left to run. You feel the cold hand and wonder if you'll ever see the sun. And you close your eyes and hope that this is just imagination. Girl, but all the while, you hear a creature creeping up from behind. Well, it's John Bradshaw Layfield, and you're out of time, because this is Thriller. Thriller night. And no one is going to save you from the beast that is about to strike. You know it's Thriller. Let's take it on a new context, folks. Thriller night. You are fighting for your life inside a killer thriller tonight. I'm going to thrill your ass tonight. Get up, get up. Darkness falls across the land like evil. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize y'all's neighborhood. And whoever's asked shall be found without the soul for getting down. Must stand and face the hounds of hell, the shield, and rot inside a corpse's shell. I'm going to thrill your ass tonight. I am going to thrill your ass tonight. Oh, baby. I'm going to thrill you tonight. Because this is a thriller. Yeah, that's right, folks. Because this is a thriller. Because this is thriller. Because this is thriller. Get up. Get up. I am going to thrill your ass tonight. I'm going to thrill you tonight. JBL is going to thrill you tonight. And you know why? Because this is Wrestler's Court.
Fanboys, hard-traveling 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 fanboys.